Welcome to the Federal Executive Forum series on Federal News Network, proudly celebrating 16 years. Here's your host, Luke McCormack.
Good afternoon and welcome to this month's show. I'm Luke McCormack. During today's show, we will discuss critical issues facing government and industry leaders as they roll out a zero trust architecture. With me on today's show are Kevin Bingham, Zero Trust Technical Lead, NSA Cybersecurity Directorate; Devarius Peoples, Chief Information Officer, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers; Stephen Hernandez, Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Education; Paul Morris, Chief Information Security Officer, CDC; Jim Richburg, Public Sector Field CISO and VP of Information Security at Fortinet; John Davis, VP Public Sector Palo Alto Networks; and Joseph Hamblin, Department of Defense CTO at Verizon. Well, NIST published 800-207, the ZTA, as they call it, Zero Trust Architecture, back in August of 2020. And then an executive order came out from the White House just recently, almost a year later, citing a lot of Zero Trust Architecture implementation requirements, et cetera, et cetera. You all have been at this for quite some time. Kevin, let's start with you. Tell us about the state of the state about Zero Trust Architecture in the community and certainly at NSA.
Oh, so thank you. So for us, we've been focused on trying to continually advance and improve our customers' networks over time. And we've, for a good decade had this belief that that the assumed breach model was a really good one that customers needed to take into account. But what we found was that there were a lot of folks that continued to just do things the way they'd done them in the past, right? The ability to have the confidence to break away from that legacy mindset of those programs and those activities that you've been doing in the past to do something different and new is hard, even when you accept that an assumed breach model is what you have to go with. And 2 years ago, when we started studying how can we get a push for improving the security on the inside of some of our networks, we looked at the zero trust model and thought, you know, that it gave a nice disciplined approach to start being able to no kidding, understand different pillars of functional capability areas that people needed to start putting attention into. And that's what really attracted us to it, that we'd be able to have a security model, a paradigm change in the way we do it to accept that assumed breach model and actually do some things that are different. Start, no kidding, locking down those privileged accounts and those accesses from the users and the devices, and stop the adversary's ability to maneuver through the network. So we're pretty excited about it. We think that as the adoption of this security model starts to gain momentum, and as people start seeing positive results of their work in this space, that we'll see not only improvements across the federal and DoD space, but also in the vendor community too, to support the needs of their customer base.
Stephen, how about over at Department of Education? You all have been on this journey, as we like to call it. Tell us about the state of the state as to how things are going over there.
Yeah, and first, I'd like to touch on this idea of the architecture. Almost 3 years ago now, when Sylvia Burns and the CIO Council actually came up with this wild idea, and came up with, hey, let's look into, is it the right time at that time to explore zero trust networks? And that was an interesting distinction, because the first request was, let's just really focus in on that layer three and see, what the art of the possible is. We pulled together several working groups, government focused, especially with our friends out at the NIST Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, ACT, IACT, ATARC. A lot of groups started pulling this apart. And particularly on the government side, we said, you know what, this is much bigger than layer three. And if we're going to do this right, we really have to talk about the whole seven layer model. We got to touch every single element of it. That's not networks, that's an architecture. And that's how we landed on zero trust architecture versus something like zero trust network. We knew we had to evolve it to be more encompassing. At the department, we look at it and we look at the four big pillars, especially if you look at the ACT-IACT model. The NIST model aligns nicely, and others break it out in different ways. But for us, it's four big pieces. We're looking at data. Both, do we know what those crown jewels are, and can we collect the data necessary from our fabric of sensors throughout the enterprise to know what's going on around us? We have ICAM. Identity is absolutely core to what we're doing. And for us, that's largely in our ICAM program. But there's other elements of identity that we're still looking at building out and how to, especially around non-person entities, how do we continue to evolve that space? And we have the trust engine, and NIST calls it the policy engine. That's an area that where we're pushing hard, and we're looking at things like the Technology Modernization Fund as to how do we take some of the cool technology that's out there, AI, AML, robotic process automation, and bring it in from an enterprise perspective across the entire enterprise, which is frankly really hard to do. Lots of ZTA solutions out there do have elements of machine learning and AI built into that particular product space or service space, but is it enterprise-wide and can it co-mingle with other things? Varying degrees of capability there. And then finally, there is that control fabric, the control plane. And that's another area of work for us that we're driving hard, probably the most nascent and on the horizon for us, because we just awarded EIS. We're getting lots of incredible technology through that service offering, software-defined network, perimeter, and WAN. All of that's going to be necessary technology, along with some new ways of encryption. You bring it all together, and that's kind of where we're at right now. And I think if you look across the federal space writ large, you're going to see similar in terms of where folks at. Some folks are a little further ahead, especially in the control plane. Other folks are still trying to get their arms around, you know, do I have an enterprise data lake where I can put all this great data and then use it to throw AML at it and eventually have AI make smart decisions?
Paul, you were at a very complex operating component. You're now at another very complex operating component. Tell us how you're doing on this journey about putting this framework together.
I really like what Kevin and Steve have said and took it really from a strategic level down to, you know, what we're doing. So, you know, hard work at the CISO councils, up to the CISO council as to where we're going. You know, it takes some policy and it takes a lot of people to roll up their sleeves, but there's a lot of existing projects that we've been after here for years in different places in the enterprise under different teams that when you step back and think, and I love this, it is an architecture, it is a framework, and how do you bring them together so that we can start to think about establishing trust in any user, in any device, accessing any data, and bringing those together so a decision can be made at that point in time, is this the right connection? So going down to, you know, some of the things that we have going, we're taking advantage of the, you know, the Tech 3.0 opportunities that are available to us and bringing a solution that brings cloud access directly down to the user. That's really an opportunity to take SaaS technology and really also provide that tech security monitoring capability that's so important. On the upside to our users, we don't have to backhaul all that data back to our data center up through a single tick from the department, reducing that latency as we're finding ourselves all in these cloud, multi-cloud environments. So that's a big plus to me is bringing those things together. We're also working really hard right now on bringing identity access controls into our next generation firewalls. I mean, that's a very technical thing, but you know, in the past it was, you know, a port and a protocol and maybe an IP address and you kind of left alone. Well, we know based on the attacks and breaches and ransomware attacks, they're taking advantage, as Steve would say, you know, above layer five, and they're coming in at the application and user. So thinking about how to use namespaces instead of IP addresses, specific users or groups, that's that part of the decision policy point of saying, do they really need access to this data? Along with network segmentation, and we're starting to build that architecture and that framework where I think we're going to see results long-term of keeping folks out of our networks.
Jim, how about over at Fortinet? You all are right smack in the middle of it there, right? You're seeing it on sort of both ends. Tell us what you're seeing out there. What's the state of the state these days?
So Luke, we've been focused on helping these departments and agencies build the foundations, the functional capabilities that are laid out in 800-207, and especially in the areas of identity management, access control, and applying and enforcing least privilege. And I'll give you three quick examples. On the user identity front, we recently helped one cabinet agency create the identity to upgrade what it was doing, a multi-factor authentication, and integrate it with its existing user identity program for about a 50,000 user population. On device management and access control, we've helped numerous others work on identifying and defining security policy for headless devices. We recognize we're now in a world where IoT and operational technology are our new reality. That with the post-COVID normal, you're going to have things like smart building technology and HVAC, things that you can't really update. So you need to track the behavior of those devices. You need to do that virtual patching to work around their vulnerabilities, and you need to alert to abnormal behavior. And we've helped a couple of other agencies with broad operational networks move that policy enforcement engine that Stephen talked about closer to that edge where the localized data is, be able to have these smaller firewalls that could do the segmentation and still share data as if it's one federated network. So this is what we're trying to do in industry, help them build the foundations you need to make the pillars of 800-207 work.
John, how about over at Palo Alto? Once again, another entity that's really right in the middle of this zero trust architecture fabric, if you will. Give us the state of the state.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Just like my good friend Jim Richburg said, we're also committed to helping our government partners on this journey. In terms of a progress report, we're going to see shortly how the departments and agencies are meeting the executive order requirements for zero trust architecture, because the homework is coming due very soon. You know, it was the 12th of May that the Biden administration issued that EO on improving the nation's cybersecurity. I have a feeling that it had probably some fuel underneath the fire based on things such as solar winds and other special events that we've experienced over the past 6 months. And the EO lays out a series of actions that federal departments and agencies are going to have to take to strengthen their cyber defenses, including within 60 days, so due in the next couple of days, each agency head has got to develop a plan to implement a zero trust architecture and incorporate the migration steps that the NIST has outlined in the standards and guidance. So, you know, from my perspective, the EO section on modernizing federal government cybersecurity in particular includes that strong emphasis on the importance of adopting a zero trust architecture across all network and cloud environments by leveraging those NIST standards. The executive order, I think, represents an important step, but it is a journey. We've been partnered with NIST and its National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence since early 2018 in working to define industry-leading standards for zero trust architectures. And I just want to compliment NIST on its outreach to many out here in the industry in a partnered effort to try to help do this. So we think we can help, and NIST plays a key role in being able to do that.
Joseph, how about over at Verizon? Once again, another major player in the middle of enabling this zero trust architecture across the community.
Thank you, Luke. Yeah, we have a large base of existing TIC 2.0 customers that we've been working with to help them develop plans to meet the executive order, you know, migrate that up into a TIC 3.0 solution, which includes SASE solutions and SD-WAN capabilities. One of the challenges a lot of customers are facing is where to get started. And the executive order really puts an emphasis on collapsing that timeframe and coming up with a direction. So performance, we want to maintain performance. And some of my colleagues on the panel have also mentioned, I think an area that I think is very critical is around identity. You know, generally, typically on the network side, there's a separation between the actual user in front of the device and the device itself. So we're focused in on collapsing that down so that we have a device, we know who the actual user of that device is, so we can start making, identity decisions, what resources and they should get access to.
Tavarius, how about over at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers? I, as the Chief Information Officer, right, you're it, so to speak. And no doubt that you all are well on a journey there to implement the capability. Tell us the state of the state.
Yeah, so good morning. It's been interesting state at the Corps of Engineers. We've received the executive order. The good thing is things were progressing before the order came out. So when we look at zero trust, some of the things that we've done, and we've had good conversations with the federal CIO council members on zero trust, We've also had good conversations with internal to the Department of the Army on some of these things. So we've developed what we call a zero trust playbook. The zero trust playbook goes through about 12 different areas, because when most people talk about zero trust, you only see it maybe from about three different perspectives. But we've gone from all aspects of zero trust to include the training aspects, the training from the executive level down to the technician that is responsible for implementing those things as well. Because ultimately, in order to implement and execute, you have to be trained. And we put a heavy emphasis on the training of our personnel. One of the things we've also begin to do is look at zero trust from the perspective of not just IT, but OT as well. Because from the Corps of Engineers, we have a heavy civil mission. And that civil mission includes working with a lot of the levees, locks, and dams at the local state level. And with that being said, we support those state levels when it comes to disaster recovery, waterway missions, critical infrastructure, and those type of things. And that's one area that we believe could be enhanced even as we work to meet the order of the executive order that was published. So we're looking at it from all aspects, OT, IT, and how do we implement our zero trust framework through a playbook? And that playbook also constitutes training as well.
Well, listen, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Federal Executive Forum on Federal News Network.
This is Bob Fortna. At Fortinet Federal, we understand government cybersecurity professionals want to reduce operational challenges, make cybersecurity more manageable, and deliver actionable information. Our integrated and automated solutions reduce complexity and ensure mission success at speed and scale. Fortinet is a leading U.S. cybersecurity company with a 20-year track record of innovation. See why agencies rely on Fortinet Federal. For more information, go to fortinetfederal.com.
Advancements in technologies present federal agencies with both opportunities and challenges. At Verizon, we embrace those challenges. Verizon invests billions in our global networks every year to deliver secure data reliably. Our advanced communication solutions and modern call centers connect your workforce and citizens in the office, in the field, and internationally. We're committed to modernization that delivers better mission results faster. Verizon, we don't wait for the future, we build it. VerizonEnterprise.com/federalIT.
Zero Trust security has rapidly evolved from a theory to a practice, and Palo Alto Networks is committed to helping the government establish its Zero Trust strategy. We offer protection, whether your agency is on-prem, in the cloud, or using a hybrid combination of both. And since Zero Trust is a long-term practice that offers optimal security when implemented correctly, it makes sense to work with a trusted partner. For more information on Palo Alto Networks' end-to-end security framework, go to paloaltonetworks.com/USFederal.
Welcome back to the Federal Executive Forum on Federal News Network. We're talking about the implementation of zero trust architecture. And I'm going to go over to you, Paul, and give us an example of a program that you've snapped in a piece of the zero trust architecture, if you will, over there at CDC.
I would really have to point to, our privileged access management efforts. These things work when you have folks who understand the complexities of what that means. It brings the elements of separation of duties and least privilege, which are so critical in defending against an adversary. But our program of is really advanced past just, managing an Active Directory, but installing technology so that when we grant access, there's a lot of administrative and technical checks that are along the way to make sure that you're granted access to a use case or need that you need to with elevated privileges. So we go through those checks, and before we grant that, we cycle your credentials, your username, password every time that you use those. We throw them in the trash, and then we watch them and make sure that those folks who are using those elevated privileges are staying where they should be. Are they in the building that they should be? Are they working during the times that they should be? Are they trying to give themselves more privileges? Those things set off alarm bells that make us all go running, and we're constantly looking. And we added to that over the holidays when we were working through the Christmas and New Year's times, looking at the Office 365 and the Exchange challenges we had, looking at those logs from what's going on in our cloud and our Exchange environments. So we continue to evolve that, and we're just going to continue moving that out to all programs, out to a mobile device and into the cloud. That is so critical for making sure that people only have the privilege they need for the job that they're doing, And then we make sure it doesn't change unless we actually make that change.
Kevin, let's go over to you at NSA, recognizing the directorate you're in. Perhaps you can't cite a specific program, but maybe you can talk to us about the steps and strategies you're advising others to use in regards to some of those programs.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So my team is externally focused. So we're focused on customers and in our effort to learn and help customers get to zero trust, we see a number of different examples, and we've worked with a number of different partners along the way. And we've seen those efforts that work well and get up to speed quickly, and those that don't. I would say that one of the attributes of a successful zero trust program is really getting that full buy-in from the senior leaders of the organization, all the way down to those engineers, the architects, the administrators, the implementers of the capabilities themselves. When we see that, things roll pretty quickly. When we don't see that, it's not that the organizations don't come around to recognizing the value of zero trust, but it slows things down a lot. So that's an attribute of a successful program. Make sure you've got that full support of the organization buying in to begin with, and that's fantastic. This is a paradigm change, right? So we need to make sure that people aren't just saying, sure, I'm doing some zero trust, and I know that I got to worry about users and devices and whether or not those devices are able to access resources, but accepting that an adversary is assumed in the network, you really need to have that there in order to drive change, in order to drive those, as Mr. Morris said, those protections of those privileged accounts and being paranoid about those. It's not paranoid. It's the way we should have been doing things for years, and that assumed breach model helps us get there. So understanding that paradigm change to drive changes within your network. If you are on an open Wi-Fi coffee shop network, you're trying to secure that, how would you do that differently, right? It's a really good mental exercise to think about the capabilities that you choose. It's not about the technology either. It's about the implementation of the capabilities, about the implementation of the model itself. We've seen customers buy new products, and we've seen some military partners do it with very little cost using enterprise software licenses and capabilities. Successfully. So that is fantastic, but ultimately the resources need to be there both on the people side as well as the funding side. And then I would also say this is another important point based on programs that we've seen that have been successful is methods to do validation, right? And so an example of that could be bringing a red team in, right? So it's really great to have a red team assessment that has baselined your environment in the past and then be able to measure your effectiveness as you start rolling out zero trust in the future to see where you're doing better. Are you shutting the red teams down, or are they still able to get around? If they are, then have them help you figure out what changes need to happen in order for you to tighten up that network.
We're seeing
success out there with a little going a long way, right? So people start rolling out with an understood and properly implemented zero trust model, we start seeing success from those red team assessments pretty quickly.
John, how about over at Palo Alto Networks? Can you give us an example of a program where you're seeing this work very well? Perhaps there's already some technology in place and they're just reconfiguring it to snap into the overall framework and enable a piece of the zero trust architecture.
Yeah, Luke, if you look at the direction that NIST is heading and that the EO is aligning to, I think that is a good model for a successful program. It's the right framework and it's complete. And let me just, not to insult anybody, but to go over the components of that, three core components: the policy enforcement point, the policy engine, and the policy administrator are those three core components. And then you've got to have the four functional components addressed, and that's the data security component, the endpoint security component, and as we've heard so many times earlier, the identity and access management component. But don't forget about that fourth component, the security analytics component that encompasses all the threat intelligence feeds and traffic and activity monitoring for an enterprise. It gathers the security and behavior analytics about the current state of assets and continuously monitors those assets to actively respond to threats or malicious activity. So I believe that companies like Palo Alto Networks, if they're going to be a good partner in this journey, they've got to demonstrate how our capabilities align to those core and functional components.
Very important piece of it to kind of bring it all together, and a critical way of attempting to implement the various pieces and parts. Stephen, how about a Department of Education? Give us an example, if you will, of a piece of the framework or a step that you've taken, or perhaps you've got it all done, who knows, in regards to the ZTA, as we like to call it.
So I think I've said it several different ways, but I think my favorite is, this is a lifestyle. I think I'm safe in saying zero trust is the pursuit of perfection. And we will likely never get there, but we're going to pursue the hell out of it until we get as close as we can. Having said that, I think for us, one of the areas that I'd like to highlight is around what we're doing with data. And so for us, when we look at zero trust, from the cybersecurity perspective, we said, you know, the standard idea of a SIEM or even a data warehouse is not going to be sufficient for us as we look into the future, the next 5 years, 10 years, when it comes to zero trust architectures. So for us, we started almost 2 years ago building a cyber data lake. And the whole concept being that we want the native data in its raw format, accurate, thorough, timely. And if there's data out there in the environment that leads to information about cyber risk, it needs to be in our data warehouse our data lake, or accessible by our data lake in a data lake fabric. And so for us, what we've done is one, we made some good architectural decisions there. One, we built it in the cloud. So extensibility and elasticity is not an issue. We throw more money at it and wow, it gets bigger. It's pretty cool how that works. But the other part is now that we're looking at how do we then make use of all that data, we're doing some pretty cool stuff with our human skill sets as well. We're bringing on actual data scientists into, say, our security operations space, because they're going to be the ones that are going to help us train the machines later. But first, we have to have folks have a great idea of what data we have, what it looks like, where there might be nuances to that data, and then also where we need to build out, say, a data warehouse-like capability, which in our case is our SIEM use case. It's effectively just a data warehouse within that data lake, that we have the right folks and the skill set to do it. And then as we bring on additional zero trust capabilities, one, they have to be able to feed into that ecosystem for data, but also they need to be able to leverage what's in that ecosystem. So really cool space right now. We call it our data dominance initiative, stealing some thunder from our friends over in the DoD side. But that message resonates. Folks get it. They're like, oh, my logs need to be in your data lake. Okay, we'll make it happen.
Joe, how about over at Verizon? Give us an example of where you're seeing this being implemented in a fantastic way, or maybe a not so fantastic way.
Yeah, thank you. We have, our customers are focused on the network. A lot of them, again, are at the TIC 2.0 level, which, now they're trying to move up into protecting the cloud resources. And one of the challenges they struggle with, like I said before, is how to get started. So we're working with them, really focused on DHS and the CIS organization. Sean Connolly and his team have been really good, have created some use case patterns that our customers can sort of follow, that one being the remote user. And a lot of that focuses around the classic VPN. You get access into the entire network, which is not really, in the zero trust type of vein. So they're implementing more what I call application-application type of VPN technologies. And as many of the colleagues in the panel have mentioned, you can't do it all at once. So when we work with our customers, we're trying to do sort of the crawl, walk, run, where we do something. We got to make sure that we train and educate the users on what's going to happen, because the user experience may change. You want to make sure that they're on board with what's going on, so that it's successful. I also think CDM, continuous diagnostic and monitoring, now that is part of the TIC 3.0 program, I think that's really key, because now we bring the endpoint into it as well. So not only are we authenticating the user to a specific device, only give them access to that, but we're also making sure that the endpoints are all compliant, which is really key, so that we have the whole thing is all integrated together. A lot of your SASE solutions now are tightly coupled, tightly integrated with your endpoint solution. So it's not, you know, this distinct technology operating independently. Now it's all integrated together.
Various, you talked about the education piece, which is really clutch. Give us an example of another piece that you've implemented there that you'd like to highlight.
Yeah, so I think one of the things we try to emphasize at the Corps of Engineers is how do we meet the end user where they are? How do we meet that engineer at a distant insight, enabling them to be able to do their mission effectively and efficiently? Because ultimately, IT, from our perspective, is an enabler, right? So a lot of times we use a lot of technical terms, we talk a lot of technical things, but an end user says, what does this mean to me? So at the end of the day, we begin to take the conceptual aspects of zero trust and begin to operationalize that concept. So with that being said, from a DoD perspective, many are probably aware of the CVR, which is the commercial virtual remote environment that was just recently decommissioned due to the fact that we're beginning to modernize and think a little bit differently. But CVR was a great example of how we operationalized the zero trust methodology and concept due to the fact that you have a major weapon system being that of the Microsoft Teams capability, which enables collaboration or mission collaboration to an end user through a mobile device. That means you can do your job effectively anywhere and collaborate efficiently with anybody throughout, whether that was a department or the federal space, DoD or non-DoD entities. And with that being said, being that we were in many different zones or different areas or departments, whether you were Air Force, Army, Navy, throughout DoD, you had the ability to connect with all of your partners. So that means being able to allow all, deny all, allow by exception, partitioning to allow for those that need access into their mission critical data, mission critical elements, being able to have good access to view and receive those logs and communicate externally with vendor partners with regards to being able to secure that information as well. So that was a very good example of how we operationalize the concept of zero trust to enable the end user to effectively be able to perform their mission. And then again, we're also looking at it from the perspective of OT, because taking something such as HVAC, when you think about construction, being able to build different buildings and those type of things, and you have Wi-Fi sensors and all those other things inside of the enterprise, you have to be able to deploy some type of zero trust principles in order to ensure that those OT capabilities are properly secured as you transfer buildings over to different customers. So we've done a lot in that space, and we continue to lean forward, learn and grow, but we have begun to execute on the zero trust principles and not just theoretically conceptualize some of those things as well.
Jim, how about over at Fortinet? You really have an opportunity there to stripe across a variety of communities there. Give us an example of a program that you'd like to highlight that's implementing a piece of this architecture.
So I'm going to actually riff on what DeVarius said, which is, how do you support the user and how do you operationalize this? We are asked to come in and help a major cabinet agency that has branch offices nationwide, that even during COVID had not only work from home, but mobile users. And they had, part of the agency had a law enforcement mission with investigative responsibilities that required going into dodgy places on the internet. So that assumption of compromise is true. So we had to find a way to help this agency do software-defined networking, allow these investigators to be on the dark web, and by implementing zero trust, work with the assumption that if your secured device got compromised, you could still turn around and work back on the agency network without allowing those threats to migrate upstream. That's the essence of zero trust for the field user.
All right, well, we're going to start talking about priorities. I'm going to throw it over to you, Stephen. Give us your top couple of priorities as far as zero trust architecture for this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I mentioned in the data space and the ICAM space, we're rocking solid. For us, the real opportunity on the horizon is around SaaS or SASE, depending on how you want to pronounce it. That's a secure access service edge, and then also SOAR, security orchestration and automation, especially as it relates to our security operation. These two areas combined bring about 90% of a zero trust architecture into possibility. And when we think about those, we're really talking about two areas. We're talking about that idea of the control plane, and that's where a lot of that SaaS technology comes in. And the important part about the SaaS technology, and this is, someone mentioned Sean Connolly's name earlier, When we talk about, you know, how do we really move the idea of the tick? How do we move that into the cloud? Really, we're talking about SaaS. We're talking about moving the idea of a TICAP, which is a physical construct, into a virtual concept, which is now going to be in the cloud. And that's just a fundamental game changer. That combined with, for example, some of the endpoint client technology, where guess what, end user, you're no longer using a VPN, at least in the way you think you are, because that client on the endpoint is going to handle almost all the encryption, and it's going to be done without your involvement and interaction. Wow, what a win for the end user. And that's really how we start selling zero trust, as it's not only good for the goose and the gander, it's going to make your job better and easier, because a lot of the security interruptions that you may feel you have now, they're frankly going to fade away. On the source side, that gets into kind of that trust engine discussion. And how do we really start the orchestration and automation of actions, starting in the SOC, the react and response side, but then also as we start to bring on newer technologies like the software defined technologies in the networking space, SOAR gives us the capability to say, wow, that's some funky behavior going on. Why is that asset getting scanned? Because frankly, it shouldn't. And we don't know where the heck that scan's coming from. Tell you what, let's direct that over to the HoneyNet and throw up a honeypot that looks at those ports that they're looking at, and let's see what they're doing. Let's see if we can capture some tools while we're at it. When we talk about SOAR and SaaS, those are the capabilities that we're bringing to the forefront. And for us in the next 2-3 years, that's really what we're going to be driving hard on.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Federal Executive Forum on Federal News Network.
Zero Trust security has rapidly evolved from a theory to a practice, and Palo Alto Networks is committed to helping the government establish its Zero Trust strategy. We offer protection, whether your agency is on-prem, in the cloud, or using a hybrid combination of both. And since Zero Trust is a long-term practice that offers optimal security when implemented correctly, it makes sense to work with a trusted partner. For more information on Palo Alto Networks' end-to-end security framework, go to paloaltonetworks.com/usfederal.
This is Bob Fortna. At Fortinet Federal, we understand government cybersecurity professionals want to reduce operational challenges, make cybersecurity more manageable, and deliver actionable information. Our integrated and automated solutions reduce complexity and ensure mission success at speed and scale. Fortinet is a leading U.S. cybersecurity company with a 20-year track record of innovation. See why agencies rely on Fortinet Federal. For more information, go to fortinetfederal.com.
Advancements in technologies present federal agencies with both opportunities and challenges. At Verizon, we embrace those challenges. Verizon invests billions in our global networks every year to deliver secure data reliably. Our advanced communication solutions and modern call centers connect your workforce and citizens in the office, in the field, and internationally. We're committed to modernization that delivers better mission results faster. Verizon, we don't wait for the future, we build it. VerizonEnterprise.com/federalIT.
Welcome back to the Federal Executive Forum on Federal News Network. We're talking about implementation of zero trust architecture, and we were actually talking about priorities for this coming year, the live year that we're in. Kevin, I'm going to throw it over to you. What are the priorities for you all over there at the NSA?
So at NSA, my team being externally focused, and so I'll keep it to that set of priorities.
Of course.
For us, it's going to be largely customer focused, our customers being critical system owners, national security systems, to include DoD customers as well. We've been working with the Defense Information Systems Agency and Cybercom over the last year to try to create guidance documents that will help the DoD specifically as a first release understand and move towards zero trust. So DoD released a zero trust reference architecture back a few months ago, which we're hoping will help folks understand and understand within the DoD how to apply zero trust principles. Following from that, we our team is focused on partnerships with DISA to make sure that we understand what test beds we need to continue to develop in order to learn, to practice, to innovate, turn that into guidance, future guidance, and then evolve and learn how to do zero trust capabilities more efficiently, whatever those challenge areas, you know, might happen to be. And that might be in data tagging and data protection, and maybe in identity and so forth. But or analytics, and those are challenge areas for us already that we see needing help with. But But for us, it's going to be trying to stay connected with our customers in the community and try to produce the guidance that we feel like will help them in areas that that they need help.
Various, how about over at the core? What are the priorities over there for this year?
Yeah, so again, we continuing to stick with the same constant theme, I think, that we've had, meeting that end user where they are. Several critical priorities that we begin to put focus on. One is the leveraging of shared services. When you talk about zero trust, you think about shared services, you think about the federal government. That's one of the things that I personally believe that from a federal DOD side of the house, we could do a lot better job of leveraging some of the things that our brethren and other organizations have done. And through zero trust, being able to ensure that it's properly secure. So leveraging that capability to help empower the end user. The next thing I would say is the digital transformation aspects of things. Because in order to really be a world-class organization, which we continue to emphasize in Army Corps of Engineers, that digital transformation journey is very critical and key. And zero trust is an enabler. It is an enabler of mission effectiveness and efficiency. So being able to secure, protect all, with leveraging a lot of your other good cyber terms, being out of continuous monitoring and those type of things, that's also another area we're looking at. And then I think last but not least, we're putting a lot of emphasis on the data modernization, data strategy journey. Because ultimately, in order to access critical information through a mobile device, whether you're sharing it with other mission partners, that's ultimately the goal. And being able to secure that data through the zero trust methodologies and principles, it allows us to be a lot more efficient when it comes to meeting mission goals and objectives. So those are some of the critical things we're beginning to look at for FY22, or that we've identified for FY22 as we begin to evolve as a world-class organization.
Paul, how about over at CDC? Can you outline the priorities that you've got in front of you this year?
Yeah, our number one priority is to support our mission. We are still knee-deep in a response to the pandemic. We've deployed multiple national-level critical systems that support the ordering, tracking of vaccines, tracking of testing, and then bringing that data from across the nation, whether it's a small public health department at the state level, all the way to our data stores. And how do we make sense of that quickly, put that in an area? So we're talking data analytics, we're talking accessibility. We're trying to get that to the people who need it quickly to make decisions at the national level, but down to the state and local level. So it is a big data challenge, and there's an opportunity to add that to what we've also received funds for is our specific public health data modernization initiatives that we have, which are allowing us to upgrade really legacy systems of data collection, supporting all the mission areas of CDC. And we're bringing those to the cloud. We're bringing that data into a data lake and into multiple areas. So it gives us an opportunity now, as we're doing this change, to apply the zero trust architectures, the things that we learn. And I think the opportunity, and this is a priority for us, is to make sure that we don't take the way that we were doing it in a data center. We're taking it into native cloud environments. We're leveraging the zero trust of segmentation and looking at users and who has access, and then making it easier for our user. Again, we need to get the data to whoever needs it, where they need it. And then I would say, you know, one of the big things is we move into these multi-clouds that we can then monitor securely and provide access, is we are moving towards an area where we can move data back and forth between clouds, between the premise to the cloud, do that quickly, securely, leveraging the technologies that we've talked about by people and applications that are trusted in this framework that we do. So there's a lot of work on policies, a lot of work, but again, we need to embrace the future to really take hold of the modernization and innovation that we're undertaking.
Well, we're going to swing down and start talking about the future. And I want to start with you, Joe, over at Verizon. And if you could outline, you know, fast forward a couple of years, what are you expecting out there? What's the demand signal that you're getting from the customer base in regards to zero trust architecture?
Yeah, Luke, thank you very much for that. Yeah, 5G is an area of focus area for Verizon. We expect 5G, as things go forward, to become really a key technology that's going to really allow us to implement these zero trust. That protocol allows, especially with explosion of IoT devices now, and that's just going to continue. More and more sensors will get out we put out there. Someone mentioned earlier HVAC systems, and they're going to be temperature. So it's going to be just a plethora of different sensors out there. With 5G environment, we can do network slicing. We can isolate those devices. Also, it provides a lot of capabilities to the end user to be able to remote and get access to the resources. So that's, and we want to blend 5G into, as I mentioned, zero trust, but as well as into the TIC program. Right now, the TIC program is coming out with a 5G use case that we're participating in, as well as I see that, you know, continuing of the SASE and SD-WAN, what I call network as a service, those type of technologies are going to be really impactful into our customers. The DoD community has been really aggressively pursuing EITaaS type of solutions. And I expect that we're going to start seeing that on the public sector side as customers look to outsource, you know, their IT as a service. And so being able to have these capabilities, like you know, again, the TIC 3.0 capability, SASE, SD-WAN, network as a service, and then leveraging the 5G, we'll be able to provide a comprehensive, end-to-end solution for our customers.
John, how about over at Palo Alto? I would imagine that going forward, you all are always trying to stay ahead. Probably got some things in the petri dish. What's it look like out there? What's the demand signal from Palo Alto?
Yeah, thanks, Luke. The way I look at it, at its core, zero trust done right enables a cybersecurity posture where only authorized users are allowed access to authorized applications with authorized content and data on authorized networks from authorized devices using authorized processes, and everything else is prohibited. Easy to say, very hard to do. And we recognize that organizations need help with practical implementation of zero trust. So for a vision of the future, we're developing a zero trust design service to help translate an organization's zero trust strategy into practical implementation. So we're not just someone who's gonna plug a capability into your plan. We wanna help you develop that plan in the first place. Four basic steps: help you identify the critical assets. Second step, complete the asset discovery and flow mapping. So after the critical assets are identified, create an inventory of the assets and map flows to them. And this step is often the most challenging and time consuming, but there are different tools available for logging and analyzing network flows based on your network and access. Third step, create a zero trust architecture, design built on the principles to include segmentation requirements, privileged access controls, endpoint controls, security analytics, and functional needs. And then finally, develop the implementation plan that should work to minimize the impact to production workflows. So with the architecture design and implementation plan in hand, organizations can then be empowered with multiple options to execute the implementation. So that's what we're trying to do, is to help organizations design it and work through a practical implementation of zero trust.
Jim, I know you're doing that as well over at Fortinet. What's it look like in a couple of years from your perspective?
So Luke, we've talked a lot about zero trust architecture and its complexity. What we've got to do, you're looking at a half a dozen or more functions that you need to perform. And that's a lot of stuff to buy or build and to maintain. So it's about ensuring zero trust between user and a service, a location. So can you get it down to two components? Something that you do at the enterprise end, whether it's on-premise or in the cloud, where you got to probably have a Swiss Army knife in terms of zero trust, and something that you do at the endpoint, at the client end. And we've actually already got the proof of concept that we're piloting with multiple federal agencies about how to simplify it so that it's not 6 to 10 things that I have to actively manage, but something that can be down to two. And as I look farther into the future, it's gonna have to be about convergence. We've talked about software-defined networking, accelerated migration to the cloud. We're getting to a point where security and networking are gonna be inseparable. So it's going to have to be incumbent on us to think about how do we enable and secure connections between users, data, and computing resources, regardless of location. And that's going to come down to, can I do that with zero trust principles? So zero trust is going to go mainstream.
Paul, they say it takes 7 to 9 years to get this fully implemented. Stephen will tell you, you're never fully implemented. I tend to agree with that. What does it look like for CDC in a couple of years? When you look around in 2 years, where do you think you are on the journey?
I have to agree with Steve. This is really a lifestyle choice. This is a change in how we manage and provide that critical service to the enterprise and our customers. It's not just, you get accounts over here, you have tickets over here. I mean, it's bringing together the organization of really service as needed of IT. I see that, this is going to be that standard going forward. What I really like here is the fact that we're going to do a lot of work here based on the executive order to really codify architecture and direction in cloud security, software development security, supply chain, and zero trust. All these things are coming together. So there's also a big piece in there that says we're going to change the FAR. We're going to change the way that we buy services and partner with technology partners. And then we're going to build that trust in that third-party ecosystem of partners. So all of this is coming together. That's going to make it easier, I think, in the future, so that when we have a business need where there's, hey, I need something in a hurry, I've got this new threat or challenge I need to overcome with technology, somebody comes to the table and there's a clear way I need to join and I need to act, and it's going to be like this. Right now, we're looking for that policy, that playbook, that sense of direction. Those things are all coming together now. I think in 2 to 3 years, a lot of that work is going to be done, documented, and then we're all going to say, okay, well, where do you fit? What are the gaps? And then I can talk about what's missing instead of trying to evolve. So I see this as a great way forward. And again, it's not one tool, not one solution, and it's going to take an entire team to make this work.
Stephen, you've been at this for quite some time. You were involved with sort of the origins of putting together a lot of this at the council. Where do you see the Department of Education on their journey over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so I think the immediate, of course, the SOAR and the SASE. I think looking beyond that, though, if I were to read the tea leaves, I think that we're going to see is a continued push towards this idea of shared services and, frankly, software as a service for a lot of the mission-focused areas in the department. And I think what that means is that we're going to continue to abstract away, and we're going to continue to say anything below layer 5 is absolutely untrusted. 6, we're a little shaky. We're really going to focus up on that application level in terms of how we're looking at zero trust. And I think that's where necessarily this evolves and this moves to where we have greater separation of the trust layers and up until the point where we're saying we're actually only going to deploy trust and we're actually only going to think about trust at layer 7. But that's going to be a fundamental shift in how we think about business, because we're going to have to lean really hard on our application development folks and helping them get up to speed on what zero trust means. And when they're developing software as a service, which is what we all love to consume, because from our side, that's the easy button. But we need to make sure that they then have the right architectures and the right approach from a software development perspective to be able to integrate with that zero trust ecosystem. And I think that's going to be the future. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see some smart players in the field say, you know what, we're going to handle it all at layer 7, and we're going to show you how we do it. We've got great telemetry. We got data about behavior and actions within that software layer, and we integrate with your data lake. We're happy to take actions from your trust engine. I think that's going to be the future. It's going to be a real hard road to get there, because there's some transformative shifts in the software development mindset that are going to have to take place to make that happen.
Tavarius, you laid out some real crisp, concrete steps you're taking. What does it look like in a couple of years? Presumably, you've got those steps done, and you're on to the next handful of implementation capability. What are you expecting to see over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so several things. When we think about the modernization roadmap, things continue to change, right? So we're living in what we call the new now. It's not the new norm, it's the new now, because you never know, tomorrow things may completely change. However, as organizations, as companies, and the world continues to evolve, the world in which we once knew users coming into an office 12 hours a day, then trying to commute back home and do more work, those type of things are becoming less and less more common. So with that being said, how do we again meet the end user where they are? We have to really embody and embrace this concept of remote work, because remote work will be here. And with that being said, a lot of the technical dialogue and terms that we're using, zero trust, continuous monitoring to secure, the lacking of VPN or the using of it, we have to begin to think about how we can meet that remote user. And in 3 to 4 years, the way we see things or the way we envision it, especially from an IT perspective at the Corps of Engineers, is users, we only may have 10% of our users that go into the office. So with that being said, it's less more of a LAN-WAN connection, but more so of a remote connection, a Wi-Fi enabled connection. And that allows us to look at things such as 5G to be able to employ or deploy a lot of these technical things. So in 3 to 5 years, I think several things will happen. One, funding. How we pursue funding from a federal perspective will probably change. Because with that being said, in order to leverage a lot of this new technology and capabilities, it's going to force us to think about things from multiple years versus just the year of execution. Because a lot of our funding dollars, when we look at funds, we do have that one year time on a lot of our money. But how can we take advantage of multi-year dollars to help move modernization efforts and initiatives forward? And I think those are the things we have to begin to look at. So in 3 to 5 years, some of those high-level funding initiatives and policies may end up changing, because in order to really move things forward, you have to look at those things. Because if you don't have the funds and the leadership investment, then you can't do any of these things. So I think that's something that the larger organization, larger federal government, DOD, we'll probably end up taking a look at. How do we source and build IT from a funding perspective?
Kevin, you're sitting at sort of the catbird seat, if you will, looking across the community. What are you expecting out there? What's sort of your marker 2 years out?
So we'll be watching that closely. We always start, and I like to refer back to whenever we're talking about the vision of what we're trying to achieve, a General Nakasone quote from a Foreign Affairs article that he helped co-author last year, and it really gives my team sort of the focus of what we're all trying to achieve. And we try to continue to explain this to our critical network and system owners, and I'm going to read it just to make sure I don't get it wrong, but he says, for Zero Trust, the goal is simple but strategic. We aim to prevent toe holds from turning into beachheads, so that a single compromise will not threaten the military's ability to accomplish its mission. Right. And ultimately, that's really what we're trying to do. And as a former, red teamer myself, spending 7 years being frustrated that we just weren't putting the attention into the right places inside the network, I'm really excited, to see a change in this security model. I think it's going to take a little time to get everyone rolled out. Many people have already said on this call even that it is a journey. I believe that we continue to improve, but we never finally get there. But what we're already starting to see at big department levels, certainly within the DoD, is a better alignment between different projects and programs that are out there. Those projects that were hard in the past, and they might have been, data tagging, data protection, are starting to get the attention that they need, because we know that this is a data-centric strategy that ultimately it's about the data and the assets and the services that we need to be protecting. That those will also get the funding that they need and the measurements that they need to progress on. So it's allowing us to pull from those legacy programs, perhaps, manage our portfolios a little bit different to manage the money a little bit better. And then from a vendor's perspective, it's real positive. Just seeing as we all come to agreement on what seems to be a very common understanding of Zero Trust, what things we still need. In fact, I mean, John Davis already touched on a challenge area for us. It's one thing to say, hey, we need to identify our critical data assets and services that we're trying to protect. Then we need to monitor and do the analytics necessary to architect that Zero Trust environment. Again, very easy to say. It's exciting to hear that the vendor community is starting to look at how they can help make that easier for all of us, right? To turn that concept of Zero Trust into something that's real, to get those policies and those segmentation gateways or access control engines that we need to provide appropriate access to data. We've got a bright shiny star that's showing us what North is right now, and it's an exciting time to be in the cybersecurity field.
We could talk all day about this, but we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to first thank all of the guests here for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us for this program, and thank you for your service. I'd like to thank the the sponsors here for supporting us on the show. I'd like to thank the good people here at Federal News Network that make our program so successful and enjoyable. And most of all, I'd like to thank the listening audience out there that tune in every month. You're listening to the Federal Executive Forum on Federal News Network.
Thank you for listening to the Federal Executive Forum series on Federal News Network. This show was produced by Trezza Media Group. If you missed any portion of this show, you can listen to the show in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsnetwork.com.